You offended me. You offended my family.
You have offended me. You have offended my family.
And welcome to the official podcast of You Offend Me, You Offend My Family. We like to call this On the Offensive. And today we have a special festival edition. And first of all, my name is Jimmy Tai. Let me introduce our fellow podcasters today. We have Justin Lin, of course, who is coming from both the production side and then I guess to a certain degree kind of programming, since you were a juror on this recent Sundance Film Festival. We've got Anderson, who is actually both on the I guess it would be the programming side as well as the consumption side, and then Phil, also from the production and I guess financing, now that you know there's this whole YouTube thing going on, as well as the consumption side. I think we have a lot of interesting perspectives here, especially in this day and age. Film festivals and this whole thing has dramatically changed, I think, especially let's say in the last 5 to 10 years, right? Between, let's say, let's use as a talking point, let's talk about the last decade really, and how much the festival world has really changed from all these different perspectives. You guys just got back from, well, Sundance, and Anderson, you went to Berlin. How was Sundance, first of all? I mean,
it was great. I mean, for me to be
back
there.
That's Justin, by the way.
To be back 10 years later and to have the perspective of being a juror, you know, it really, for me to, first of all, it was pretty emotional. I mean, that's where it all started. And to go back as a juror and to have that perspective, seeing, you know, 16 films, it really kind of gave me a sense of where kind of American independent cinema is right now. And
it's been 10 years, right?
Since exactly BLT 10 years. Premiered, yeah.
At Sundance.
Yeah. But you've gone back multiple times, right? Because we, you know,
we were back. I was back 5 years later. And so
finishing the game.
So it was 5 years, 5 years.
Wow.
And how was the Sundance Film Festival for you guys? Anderson, well, Phil, you guys both went to.
This is Anderson, and I came, you know, with, aside from, you know, just pimping it up at the Yum Yum cabin, but also it was just there for just programming, so just checking out all the, you know, Sundance is one of the, you know, major kind of festivals to go to, and just to see all the, you know, various world premieres, and I think for the most part, I think it was a pretty decent year. You know, I think it's indicative because of, you know, you're talking about, like, you know, 5 to 10 years of how, you know, festivals have changed. And I think just the whole landscape of indie filmmaking in general is that, it's much cheaper to make a film now, right? It's with digital technologies and video cameras, HD cameras and what have you. And you can, you know, edit everything on a laptop. That, you know, there's much more stuff out there, you know, and I think it's a big boon for documentaries. I think documentaries are, you know, because I think real life is just stranger than fiction in a way that that documentaries that I saw at Sundance, just everyone was on point. I was like, literally either like really impressed or just blown away, just because of the subject, you know, and I mean, I guess the craftsmanship as well. But like when it comes to more of the features, you know, narrative feature side, I thought it was interesting to see kind of this. You know, films that are made on low budget side, but at the same time trying to appeal to everyone, and they were more commercially kind of motivated or driven. A lot of like, you know, kind of light romantic comedies was the, you know, kind of the brunt of the programming at Sundance this year. And so it's interesting. You know, I liked some of the stuff I saw, but it wasn't like, you know, I would say like any kind of hard hitting kind of like. I mean, except for maybe a rare one or two films, but, you know, but for the most part, they were just kind of more very, I guess, vanilla in their subject matter.
Well, talk about one or two of the most memorable films that you guys saw coming out of Sundance.
Well, I think on the narrative feature side, I think, you know, what, you know, I guess the jury, what Justin chose, you know, Justin, yeah. The jury chose was a film called Beasts of the Southern Wild, and which I thought was, you know, definitely a Sundance-y type of, you know, indie film festival type of film that was very high concept. You know, it dealt with basically a post-Katrina kind of post-apocalyptic world where everything was like, you know, like kind of a water world kind of atmosphere. Yeah. And it had kind of like these tropes of like, you know, the African-American experience, or like, you know, just like, or living on boats and makeshift boats. And you know, there was like, you know, also, you know, even creatures in the ocean and what have you, and it was done on a, you know, low budget, and it was with, you know, and with non-actors too, and like the, and I thought that was kind of like on it took a lot of risks, so, and for the most part I think it succeeded, so that's what was great, because it was like such a risky move to, you know, aside from it being low budget, also, you know, kind of like, what, you know, what did they tell you about filmmakers? Never shoot on water and never shoot with kids, right? Like, right. And that's what they did. And I think it's like, it was kind of like a, you know, kind of like a, kind of almost in a way, it was very kind of, in a way, it was kind of a breakthrough film, because a lot of the other films were so kind of more, I guess, vanilla, you know,
yeah.
In a way.
It was, well, like, yeah, I mean, the two standouts was Beasts of the Wild and The Surrogate.
Yeah.
And...
I mean,
and it was
on
interesting.
The flip side, the series.
But also,
was,
but yeah,
yeah,
and it, but it was also interesting because those two films got snatched up by Searchlight right away. So
Fox
you can
Searchlight,
you can see that, you know, as independent cinema goes, they're independent minded in a way, but they're also very commercial.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So for the two best films to be snatched up like that,
right?
It tells you kind of where we are, you know. And I remember, you know, this is a debate. You know, 10 years ago it actually is a perfect starting point, because I remember back then, that's when people started shooting things on digital.
Digital, yeah.
On like
VX1000. Yeah.
But back then, it was still kind of like, if you shoot on digital, would it be distributable?
Right.
You know? And
there was like Indigent, right?
Exactly.
That
Indigent,
thing, you know,
Tadpole
was
in that.
Yeah.
And they had a big sale. And so the big debate was, well, with the advent of digital technology, and it started, and 10 years later now, you can actually shoot digital. And it looks like film.
Yeah.
And that's
the one
thing that I noticed is that technically...
Well, 10 years ago, like, you know, you show on DV, it looks like crap. It looks like
exactly.
DV. Yeah, yeah.
Now
yeah.
It's like, it's not a question. It's a level of the playing field. So the big question was, is that mean more talented filmmakers are going
to
come out of it? Is it more interesting films are going to come out of the fact that technology has caught up?
And what would be the answer for this year?
I think the thing is you gotta also kind of talk. I remember when we were at Sundance 5 years later, we were finishing the game, and that's when the market was about to burst. That's when they were buying up everything in that market. In 2008, everything just seemed to have crashed.
Right.
So the thing, you know, the big issue is that, do you think people are reacting? The filmmakers are reacting off of that, because independent cinema now is not in the state it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you know. So that's one of the big issues. But, you know, I have to say, I did feel like watching the films that, you know, there is a savviness that comes with the young filmmakers, you know. And, you know, instead of, I think, taking chances sometimes, if you do see films out there where it's very well made and it's almost a calling card into studio world.
Yeah.
That's something that I don't know. And Anderson's probably more a question for you, but 10 years ago, was independent cinema more independent?
Right, exactly. I think Justin hit right on the mark, is that because of the fact that the films are more now, I think, more calling cards or director's reels for, like, say, you know, because the plots are pretty conventional. So it's like, definitely, I think it's more of a calling card for, like, you know, like a bigger, studio project, or even TV, because you see a lot of independent filmmakers from even 5 years ago are now, you know, shooting episodes of The Office, you know, and what have you. So I think TV, in a way, is kind of the next level for a lot of these independent filmmakers to, you know, to work in, because there are a lot of, you know, TV is, in a way, is a renaissance and television than films, I think.
Right.
You know?
What would you say, what does that say about the health of independent cinema as a whole? Because, I mean, at least for me, the kind of macro perspective that I've seen is that, you know, what Justin, you were saying earlier was that technology should enable the more talented filmmakers to come out and stay, you know, make better movies at a cheaper cost. But the effect, the kind of opposite side of that effect that I've seen is that because of technology, so many more other people, in addition to the talented filmmakers, can also make movies. And so that's added so much to the clutter, especially in the last 3 or 4 years. I'm curious, Anderson, especially in your perspective as a programmer, have you seen this net effect where it's just harder to wade through all the submissions to try to find the gems? And because it seems to me as a whole that independent cinema, you know, hasn't had those gems that, I don't know, maybe it's just a matter of perspective, like, but, you know, whatever, like 7 or 8 years ago, it seemed like, you know, there were these indie gems that were, you know, coming out and being discovered, like, at least, you know, a few every month, whereas now it's like, gosh, well, there's so much to wade through.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you look at, I mean, you know, I mean, I work at my festivals every year, the, you know, the amount of submissions goes up and up. I mean, but, like, you know, look at Sundance, for example, they always tout their, you know, the number of how many submissions they get, and it's like, you know, I mean, if it equal, I mean, if you add up all the, you know, like, the shorts and documentaries, it's like almost like 10,000 entries. It's like, yeah, ridiculous, right? So it's like, and in a way, it's like the festival world has become much more of its own business, you know, where it is like now kind of like the theatrical window for independent films. And you know, it's much more stratified, where, you know, before it was like, okay, you know, like 10 years ago, Sundance, and Sundance is still like, you know, the creme de la creme of American festivals, but now you have South by Southwest, now you have Tribeca, now you have LA Film Fest, you know, and then you have these other windows of opportunity to, and everyone's vying for, like, you know, premier status, right? So, and in a way, like, you can, I mean, a lot of filmmakers are now utilizing the film fest, you know, film festival kind of world as a way to monetize their distribution, you know, by selling DVDs right away, or just at screenings, or even using you know, the festival screenings as just the premiere, and then releasing it on VOD right away, and so, I mean, like, in a way, it's utilizing that because there's no theatrical window anymore. They're just doing it themselves.
Right. I mean, that's something that I remember reading about, you know, because these days I don't, like, I'd be hard pressed, and, you know, we're in the field of independent cinema, but I'd be hard pressed to name, you know, the real standout films from Sundance over, let's say, like, the last 3 or 4 years, just because, you know, again, it's like a kind of attention deficit market that we're in, right?
Yeah.
And so that's why people have to capitalize on the attention right away, because, you know, it's one thing to be able to capitalize it within the matter of days or weeks, than to have to go back and, you know, 7 or 8 months later remind the same people, oh, hey, this movie's great, it's now available where you can see it.
Right.
So is that more now the issue is, you know, we can talk about, is it now being a filmmaker is about being able to survive? Do you know what I mean? Because I do think 10 years ago, you can make an independent film, but if you get a distributor, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
And you can get publicity, you can get a chance to get an audience, and you also get a chance to make another movie.
Right.
And now, because the field's so cluttered, you know, you can everybody's self-distributing and everything like that. Are filmmakers trying for self-preservation? Are they trying to basically make a film so they could go and make another movie?
Yeah, because I think that's definitely true, because you look at the deals, right? I mean, you know, Sundance is like kind of a, you know, that's the marketplace, right? And I think this year's, like, festivals, I think the result is all, you know, always like, oh, well, how many sales were there, racking up the festival? And, you know, Beast of the Southern Wild won the, you know, Grand Jury Prize, and it was bought by Fox Searchlight. But I think the deal itself was actually pretty small, you know. I think it's like, you know, like under a million, you know. Like, usually, you know, the film, that the infamous film from Happy Texas.
Oh,
like,
right.
$10 million, right? That was the, you know.
Well, here's the other thing that a lot of people don't really talk about, like, and, you know, this is obviously something that we can see from the producing financing standpoint, but people don't usually read beyond the headlines. All they read is the sale.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you think that that's a success. But it's what you were saying
right
earlier. It's relative to what that movie costs. And so, you know, one of the things that I think I've seen, again, from the macro perspective, is that movies probably, you know, from a decade ago in the independent realm, you know, obviously it's still hard, but they actually stood a chance of actually being profitable, right?
Right.
Not just picking up a deal or picking up a sale, because those numbers are meaningless, really, unless you know what the cost is,
well,
right?
Unless you're a producer or a director.
Right, right.
Beast of Southern Wild, going to Searchlight, that's a great deal for the director.
Right, right.
You know?
Exactly.
So I think that's a big financier.
Right. Okay, so this is great that you bring this up, because that's something that I don't think a lot of people usually realize, right? Because something that's beneficial to a director or an actor may not be the most beneficial to the producers or the financiers of film. And that's where a lot of independent film gets murky, right? Because if you're an actor who is used to, you know, being in studio movies and getting, you know, $1 million paychecks, you'd rather, and you saw an independent movie, right? You would rather, you know, see that movie get picked up and distributed no matter what the cost is. Let's say, you know, someone just picks it up for a P&A deal, right? You as an actor get the benefit of seeing your face plastered all over, you know, the billboards, you get that, all that added value. But the actual people who put money into the film, could stand to lose all that they put in, right? And so it's kind of having to look beyond the veil of, at least for the smart, you know, producers and filmmakers who are having to worry about all the various aspects, they have to look at these different things and realize that different people will have different agendas based off of what.
But you should go, right? About 15 months before the film festival, and who's holding the power at that point? The financiers. Mm-hmm. And the financiers are greenlighting these movies based on the talent, right? So it's a little seesaw that always happens. But I think for the health of independent cinema, is always great, you know, to see financiers do well, because that means they're going to invest more.
Right.
You know, and right now you what I also see is that if you're an independent, you know, filmmaker and you have something to say, this is the perfect time, because it would stand out above everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do see that strategically, a lot of filmmakers, I'm blown away. They're so much superior in a way, mm-hmm. that they can come out of film school and they can make a film that feels like a, you know, $30 million studio film.
Right. But is there any substance behind it?
Yeah, but the thing is that they show that they can direct content, but what they have to say, that's still, I feel like in this day and age, in the scene today, that if you have something specific to share, it will stand out.
And that's why I think Sundance created that new section next section, right, which they created, like, implemented 2 years ago. And that was kind of devoted to really micro-budget films. I don't know what the exact mandate was, but it's like maybe under $200,000 or something. But, you know, the films were, you know, I thought a lot of the films I saw at this year's Sundance, a lot of the good stuff came out of the Next program. And it was kind of weird because it kind of was, in a way, like, it looked no different. I mean, they created this, like, you know, like, quote-unquote, kind of ghetto for, like, you know, like, micro-budget films, but really, it looked no different. The films looked no different from the stuff that was in the main competition, production value-wise, you know? So I think it's, like, you know, in a way that I think Justin's right. It's, like, you know, these filmmakers are really making kind of, like, really high production stuff out of, like, very limited means.
I mean, I have a question for you, Anderson, because I'm trying to... everything that we're talking about, like, I'm trying to think of a practical, grounded example that kind of also applies to Asian American cinema. And what came to my mind was Patrick Wang's film,
In the Family, yeah.
Which, for those who don't know, I mean, it's an amazing movie that Anderson, actually, you introduced me to. And it's kind of embodies a lot of what we're talking about and this whole issue of rising above the clutter, right?
Yeah.
And why don't you tell the story? Because it got rejected by every place, and you at Hawaii, you're the one who kind of discovered it in a way and programmed it. And I was just curious because it's such an amazing film, and I would think that that's the perfect film for, like, a Sundance audience. And yet,
true.
It got rejected everywhere.
Yeah,
I was wondering what you thought about, like, why that was.
I honestly don't know. But, like, you know, it did get rejected by 30 film festivals. And, well, first of all, it's a three-hour film, you know, three-hour family drama. You know, like, it's but it was, like, beautifully shot, beautifully acted, and, you know, it was, you know, just, I think it was just, like, a kind of definitely a boon for Asian American cinema because it was an Asian American in a way, you know, like, in the sense that it was really exploring these, you know, also, like, you know, exploring these issues of being, you know, not just necessarily Asian American or being gay or what have you. It's like, you know, or, you know, just it's just really about a family story set in the South. And I think it was really kind of old fashioned in a way, kind of like, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird kind of old fashioned, but it was, like, artistically just beautifully done. You know, like, for a 3 hour film, there's only 300 shots. You know, it's like very languid, very, you know, like, beautifully shot, you know, beautifully acted set pieces. And but, you know, I don't know. I think maybe because of the, maybe because to a lot of festivals,
so
it was just
too old
fashioned.
Would you say it's the Jeremy Lin of films?
Wait, let's talk about it. It's a good segue into kind of Asian American film, where it is today. What is, now that you know, obviously have over a decade of experience here, what is a realistic expectation
Let me finish up with In the Family. So, like, you know, it premiered at my festival and then also went to San Diego Asian Film Festival and won all these awards. And then, like, you know, Patrick, who's really, you know, the director, writer, director, and star, you know, of the film, you know, just immediately released it in New York at the Quad Cinemas for a week run, and like it really garnered a lot of accolades from like it got noticed on IndieWire and New York Times, had a really glowing review in New York Times, and really pointed out like why was it rejected by so many festivals, you know, and so it kind of garnered this kind of like momentum in New York, and it got another week run, and then it got an Independent Spirit Award nomination, you know, like I don't think it was, I think it was a even like it was, I think he entered it at Los Angeles Film Festival, which is kind of part of the Independent Spirit Awards, and it didn't get in, but it, you know, it ended up getting an Independent Spirit Award, and now he's planning a slow rollout throughout the spring for his releasing the film. And so, you know, I think he's doing it on his own terms. Again, this is DIY, you know, like, and I think just because of that, you know, he's really kind of crafting, I mean, in a way, he's crafting a story, yeah, I guess in a Jeremy Lin kind of way, you know, like, crafting this story that's very interesting, that's, you know, paralleling the, you know, the fact that it's a very good movie too.
Right.
You know,
I mean, so. But if the Jeremy Lin thing were to happen in the movie world, it'd have to be something like all of a sudden the movie makes $100,000 in one weekend in two theaters, right? And then all of a sudden, well, okay, here, going back to what I was proposing originally is what is a reasonable expectation of what could happen with an Asian American film, let's say in a best case scenario and then in a so-so case scenario, right? Because I don't know, I mean, me looking at the landscape where it is, it's like, would something like Better Luck Tomorrow, is there even a realistic possibility that like something like that would happen in this day and age?
I mean, look, what do you remember about Better Luck Tomorrow? Do you remember that it, how much money it made? You know, and I think that's the bigger question, because, you know, I think ultimately...
Yeah, exactly. How do you frame it? Like, do you want to start talking about... It's a boon for the director and star and the actors, or is it more of a boon for the financiers, like making your money back?
I think, well, in this context, we're talking about that it was actually catapulted into the more popular mainstream, and maybe, you know, obviously not at the level of a huge, you know, 2,000 plus screen theater release, but the fact that it was out in several hundred theaters that had, you know, there was a campaign.
It made 1,000 theaters, actually.
Okay, well, so it ultimately went out
to... Get it right, Jimmy. Oh,
well, I just remember the first couple weekends, it was a couple...
It was at the Mad National, goddammit.
Hey, I was there opening the weekend, all right?
That's where they filmed Zodiac.
But like, you know, is it...
It's a great theater.
Yeah. Oh, I miss it.
Is it even within the realm of expectations for an Asian American film this, you know, in this day and age to possibly even get a chance by something, you know, something like... And obviously,
I know what you're saying, but I think you're coming from a financier... I feel like that's coming from a financier point of view. And I feel like as a filmmaker, we're already in a community that's, you know, with most of the people being raised by their parents to try to get good grades and always trying to get approval. And I do feel like that, on the whole, when you see Asian American cinema, you do get a sense, you know, and by the way, this kind of goes back to Sundance a little bit, you know. I mean, we joked a little bit about, you know, there was a broadness in Sundance, but I was at this one Q&A for a film, and the actress actually said, she was surprised how many films that she saw were white people problem movies. And this is a white actress, and it was actually, I really love that she brought that into the discourse.
Yeah.
You know? But at the same time, sometimes when you watch independent cinema and you watch the you know, the people of color films, sometimes I feel like they're also kind of playing that role, you know? And so I think when you ask these questions, it ultimately, I think, you know, as a filmmaker, is a very different perspective than as a financier, because I think an expectation for a filmmaker is going to say, I want to grow and I want to make more films and hopefully I can make a living doing what I love, you know. And so that's going to be a very different thing, because, you know, I think that if a filmmaker can make a film, get publicity and somehow, you know, entrust, you know, somehow earn the trust of other financiers or executives, that's a win, you know. I think a responsible filmmaker, yeah, you want to somehow take care of everybody, but that's a whole other discussion, you know. I think in the landscape of Asian American cinema and marketplace, I mean, there's never really been, you know, I know Better Luck Tomorrow, the financier, because it was done for so cheap, you know, there was a profit to be had. You know, but other than that, like, I actually don't know any other examples of Asian American films that have made a profit. But you know, for me personally, you know, it did gave me an opportunity to make more films, and you know, I was able to, now I can say I'm a professional filmmaker, you know.
Right. Well, but I guess in terms of, you know, dispensing, you know, advice for, you know, like younger filmmakers and stuff like that, you know, you do want to kind of give them an idea of what, you know, people who would be financing these movies would like to expect, because, you know, I don't know how you guys feel about this kind of cyclical nature of Asian American cinema. I mean, is this something that you guys
see? But here's the thing, Jimmy. See, you work for a production company and you guys are awesome. Like, I'm not just kissing your ass, because I do think that you guys try to support Asian American filmmakers. And that's like,
And this is Cherry Sky Films.
Exactly. And that's probably one of the dumbest things to do.
Yeah.
But it's actually brilliant. And I love it. I love that you guys do try to support. And that's so rare, you know? And that's awesome.
But,
right?
but I'm saying is,
there are other financiers out there who, you know, would they finance films so they can have a boat party at Cannes or something like that. You know, so, you know, for filmmakers, a lot of times, you know, I always feel like, you know, you write, you do the best you can, and you hopefully write a script and you prep a movie that you want to make. And within a day of taking out to the marketplace, you're going to know exactly where it stands, you know? And that's still a good old American way of filmmaking, right? Is that, you know, and if nobody wants to finance it, it's your job to convince people to come in and finance it. And if you can't do that, that film is not going
to
get made.
Well, I think it's a great time actually to really be an Asian American filmmaker, because honestly, you can make movies for much cheaper now.
I mean,
right?
We were talking about Better Luck Tomorrow.
Yeah.
I could make Better Luck Tomorrow today for $50,000,
right?
And I'd be able to do camera moves that I couldn't do 10 years ago, because I had a 35mm, you know, camera. I had all these things. I had film that, you know, every time we shoot, I had to pay for film to get developed, and so the cost of it was crazy. So it would actually be a very different film if I shot it today, but I can do that film for, you know, a fifth of its cost.
Okay, but let me ask you, in terms of like in actual content, what were some of the, I guess, memorable Asian American movies in, let's say, the last 10 years that you can name off the top of your head?
Well, In the Family.
No,
I mean,
definitely
that's...
In the Family. I think definitely In the Family is really one of the, yeah, I guess one of the, not only one of the best films I saw last year, but for the Asian American kind of like film scene, it's like definitely one of the, in the last 5 years.
But here's
honestly.
Also the thing is that, you know, the whole thing of if the tree falls in the forest and nobody's here to hear, does it make a sound?
Right.
You know, I've been hearing about this film and I can't wait to see it.
Right.
But part of me also, you know, I mean, obviously I trust your taste, I trust Phil's taste. Like I want to see it, but how can this film get out there so that you can, you know, hopefully garner that kind of support?
Right. Well, it's coming out April 27th, like in LA, you know. So it's, you know, slowly going. You know, I mean, he's doing again the self distribution route.
Right.
And I think.
But here's the thing: is that, you know, what I was saying earlier is that, like, let's say like 10 months down the line, when it's finally available, where, you know, Justin can actually, because, you know, like, Justin's probably not even going to be in LA like at that point in time, you know, and he would be interested in it right now, fresh
well,
after.
Well, that's the thing.
You
don't necessarily need to have like. Now that's why, you know, kind of that's why the VOD space is, that's kind of like the exit strategy for a lot of these independent films, because you don't necessarily need to have a distributor. You can actually get it on VOD, you know, or on iTunes.
So,
you know,
maybe that's ultimately what I'm getting at, is maybe that there should be kind of a shift in expectations from when it, you know, the period when it was like 8 to 10 years ago, where kind of the goal in mind was definitely, oh, I've got to go theatrical, you know, that's going to be, you know, the end game. Whereas now, hey, you know, people are starting to really accept much more the idea of, hey, video on demand, it's not necessarily...
Right, I think that whoever figures out the next pipeline is going to be the next, you know, Miramax.
Yeah, exactly.
Really, you know, I think people haven't been able to figure it out yet, you know. But I think for filmmakers... You know,
I remember when you looked at the Miramax logo when it comes on screen, like, wow, I'm gonna expect something really completely different, you know?
Right.
Like, there's nothing like that really nowadays.
But we had to go to the crappy theater you know, there's some guy jacking off next to you to watch that. You know what I mean? So like,
wow.
what is
the crying game?
Yeah, the crying game.
What is the equivalent of that now? you know? And I this is the thing, is that I know there's truth to, like, you know, I remember now, you know, Albert Pujols gets signed by the Angels, right? Sure. And you hear the sportscaster, they're always like, oh, yeah, he's Latino, so he's going to be big with Latinos.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I get that to a certain extent, but the assumption that you are making a film for just a specific group of people.
Yeah.
I'm sure Patrick, you know, he just wanted to make the best film, and hopefully it's universal and everybody from different backgrounds.
Right.
But it's also being talked about in that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, even within our own community. So, you know, I, with that kind of expectation, with that kind of discourse, I don't think that's good for any film.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, in a way, I think you can be, like, you're talking about, like, the degree of Asian-ness, right, in Asian American films. I think you can definitely go balls to the wall and, like, be more specific when it comes to, like, if you want to do, like, a Korean-laced kind of family comedy or something like that. You can do it now. I mean, you don't have to make it as broad as you want. You know, you don't have to make it, again, like, you know, for the mainstream market. Because I think there's an opportunity to really, the model is basically get it out there yourself and, like, you know, build your networks, go through social media, you know, have
a fan base. But that's also, it's a double-edged sword. You know,
no, absolutely, because you're not making money.
Not even that. You're talking about quality. See, I asked a programmer from a festival programmer, and this is when everything was breaking out.
Yeah.
And I said, do you think this is great because, you know, now that technology is caught up, does that mean you're going to, instead of one Scorsese, you're going to end up with 10 Scorsese?
No, not at all.
Right?
Because you democratize the medium, but there's more shit out there.
Right.
Exactly. That's what he said. But he said, his thing, when he came back and he was saying, well, at the end of the day, the Scorsese's are always going to make it. Yeah, even with asthma or whatever, they're always going to make it.
But
I think now with distribution, that is tough, is that, you know, every day you're getting some sort of email about support this, support that. And, you know, it's like, you know, the boy cried wolf. Yeah.
Well, you know, Phil, you wrote a blog about being Kickstartered all over the place, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, I think crowdsource funding is great if you do it properly, but man, everyone's doing it.
Yeah,
and so it's hard to keep up because I get like 2 or 3 requests a day.
Right.
So do you think the solution is that it becomes like fantasy independent cinema?
That's kind of in a way what it is becoming with this whole like crowdsourcing.
Also I think it's about, it's all in a way, when you talk about the Miramax logo, it's about Miramax saying, we're going to be this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so when we go see it, we expect that.
Right.
And nowadays, everything could be on, you know, VOD or being, you know, you can watch it on your computer.
Right.
But I still feel like, at the end of the day, there's no branding of, like, what anything's about, you know?
Right, especially in the world of movies where there really is no kind of company loyalty. Like, right, no one goes to watch, you know, maybe Miramax was the exception to the rule, but no one goes to watch a Sony movie because it's a Sony movie, or a Universal movie because it's a Universal movie, right?
For a while there, you know, Sony Picture Classics,
you expect
certain things from that, Miramax, and then Focus was they're starting to carve out, you know, and obviously now Searchlight has become the crossover independent cinema, you know? So, I mean, I believe that you can create that still, but in a very, hopefully, inventive way. And and that new pipeline, I think, is the hope for, you know, filmmakers in general, but also Asian American cinema.
Mm-hmm. And with that, that's going to bring to a close the first On the Offensive Festival edition. And I feel like we've just really touched the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there's so much more to talk about. I'm sure a lot of people are interested in all these different perspectives that we have. But that'll wrap it up for today. And thank you so much for joining me, guys. And hope we'll do another one soon.
All right.
You offended me. You offended my family.
You have offended me. You have offended me.